I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Kansas voters have a choice to make next month that could affect how thousands of votes are counted. It could also save the state $1 million a year. Today, the ballot measure that looks to stop the state's practice of adjusting the U.S. Census numbers based on non-resident military members and non-resident students. We'll find out how that could impact boundary lines and legislative seats when it comes to redistricting. Then, we'd be remiss to not talk about Patrick Mahomes' injury. But first, she's an Olympic athlete, actor, and writer, and this weekend a competitor in the Kansas City Marathon. We'll learn how Alexi Pappas manages a busy life on and off the track. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Most Kansans may not know, but they'll be asked to pass judgment on a constitutional amendment next month when they go to the polls. Under the change, the state would no longer adjust its census numbers as it has in the past. The state for years has taken steps to count college students and military personnel at their permanent residences rather than where they're living at the moment. In other words, the population numbers for college towns in Kansas, like Lawrence and Manhattan, would rise slightly, while rural counties could see slight dips. It may have a small impact on the way boundary lines are drawn for congressional districts and certainly state legislative seats. The idea appears to have little opposition, and Republican Secretary of State Scott Schwab is all for it because it would save close to $1 million a year for his office. Here to talk about this amendment is Clay Barker. He's the Deputy General Counsel in the Secretary of State's office. Clay, welcome back. Nice to have you here again.
Great to be back, Steve.
You know, how concerned are you about the injury to Patrick Mahomes, and how does that figure into this whole thing?
I woke up this morning and saw it in the news. And
I'm kidding. This is not a big factor in what we're talking about here today. Well, explain how the state of Kansas, Clay, works now when it comes to counting college students and members of the military, because a big effort is made to figure out where their permanent addresses are. Tell us what happens and how this works.
Sure. This process has been done for the last three censuses, 90, 2000, and 2010. The federal census is the baseline, and it counts people where they tend to live and sleep. So students are at or near their campus, military is at or near their base. Then Kansas, only state in the country to do this, calls every student, college student, and military member, not their families, just the member, and asks them if they want to be counted where the federal census has them, not counted in Kansas at all, which doesn't affect any other state's numbers, just the Kansas numbers, or at some other location in Kansas. So for instance, my daughter's a K-State student. If we had to do this again, she'd get a call saying, do you want to be counted at Fort Hall in Manhattan or at our house in Leawood, Kansas?
And people listening right now are thinking, why on earth do we do this, Clay?
The core or the issue behind the issue here is the numbers that are used for state, not our congressional, but the state legislative districts.
Ah, not the congressional, just the state.
Congressional is always federal, but for the state, it would be how many people and where they are, what geographic location they're assigned to.
But we do this why? I mean, this change was made back in the 80s. What was the thinking behind this idea?
The thinking was that it might assist the rural areas in losing legislative representation because of the population decline.
So there was it's a political effort then to sort of keep the rural population a little stronger, to keep more legislative representation out in western Kansas, to be speaking in broad strokes here.
Exactly. The if you can think of it this way, the denser the population, the smaller geographically a district has to be. So if you can build up people, you might be able to squeeze out an extra district, predominantly rural district. Was the thinking.
I'm wondering, why would more urban lawmakers go along with that change, or were they simply outvoted back in the 80s by the strong rural caucus the state had?
I'm not sure of the political calculus back then. It also, this has played out over 50 years. Before the 1960s in Kansas, for the House of Representatives, each county had one rep, and the extra 20 were then distributed to some of the bigger counties. Then when the U.S. Supreme Court said that's not the way you can do it, Kansas had to go through some wrenching changes, and I think this was an outcome of that.
So just to be crystal clear then, so your office, if no change is made, it then has the responsibility of trying to track down all these students, all these members of the military, and asking this question. I can only imagine a college student who's a junior in college getting a phone call saying, where do you want to be counted? And they're thinking, I'm sure in their own heads, what in the world is this? Why are you calling me? How should I answer this question?
Oh, exactly. And I've talked to some of the staff that did this 10 years ago, and they said it just engendered a lot of confusion amongst people.
I can't imagine.
They were trying to outthink, like, what are they really asking? Why are they asking me this? And if you want some just quick numbers.
Please, yeah.
When this was done in 2011, there were about 119,000 people were called in the state. The census numbers had the state at about 2.8 million, so it's about 4%. 28,000 wanted to move inside Kansas. 13,000 asked not to be counted in Kansas, maybe military from Florida or college students that weren't from Kansas. 70,000 said, just leave me where I am. And about 6,000, their answers were inconsistent. They kind of said yes to both, move me and keep me, and they just were left where the federal census had them.
I can only imagine what kind of burden this places on your office in terms of having to hire extra workers, having to find these phone numbers and make these calls. How does that process work? How does that roll out?
From what I understand, the staff, I wasn't here at the Secretary of State when they did this last time, but I've talked to the staff. They would hire contractors to do a lot of the calls. They'd have to coordinate with military bases, colleges, try to track down individuals. It costs a little less than $1 million if it's done right. Another piece to this, and it takes a lot of time, but another piece is it prevents our legislature from dealing with redistricting in one of its sessions. So, for instance, they couldn't do it in 2011. They had to do all the redistricting in 2012. And I think if you remember, that didn't work out so well, and we ended up in court.
And that's because the state didn't have its numbers set. You were still making phone calls to figure out where people wanted to say where they were living, and that takes some extra time. So you had to push off the redistricting for a year then.
Right. The Secretary of State's office didn't finish this adjustment until August of 2011. By then, it was too late for our legislature to do any meaningful work. Maybe if they had had two sessions, they would have got it done. Instead of going to court.
Again, I'm just guessing that people listening to this are thinking, this is just crazy. I mean, this is just this is what makes no sense whatsoever.
Yeah, I think this was, whether you agree or not with the idea back in the 1980s of perhaps assisting the rural areas and getting a little more legislation, the bottom line that we found out after three iterations is it actually changes nothing. The people are just spread out diffusely over Kansas. There's no effect on the boundary lines. There was no buildup in any of the rural areas. Mm-hmm. If any area benefited just slightly, it was actually Johnson County, but Johnson County's so big it didn't gain any legislative districts. So the point is, why spend all the money and time if it really accomplishes nothing, which is why there was no resistance from the rural legislators.
We're talking this morning about a constitutional amendment that Kansans will be voting on next month that affects representation, perhaps. It affects the way when the census is conducted in the state. If you want to give us a phone call with your questions, 816-235-2888 is our phone number here. Clay Barker is my guest. He's the Deputy General Counsel in the Kansas Secretary of State's office. So, is there any political fallout from this? I mean, is there any reason to think that either Democrats or Republicans would benefit if this change is made?
I don't believe there's any political fallout. And both parties are supporting this. The governor's for it. Secretary of State. It's a very nonpartisan, unified effort. Not the most interesting topic. Not a lot of emotional baggage on this. But it's more of a mechanical thing. But everyone's for it just because it saves money and time and will help our legislature out.
Yeah, there's been a little opposition, maybe token opposition might be the way to describe it, a few lawmakers pointing out that, hey, this is designed to keep rural counties a little more robust when it comes to population numbers, and that idea shouldn't be forgotten here.
Right. I think in the Senate it was 40-0 for the amendment, and in our House, I believe there were 7 voted against it. And sometimes, and I don't know specifics, but people overthink this. Mm-hmm. They start thinking it'll have to do with where people are registered to vote. It has nothing to do with that. It's just where they're located for the census.
Mm-hmm. So this wouldn't affect where anybody votes then. If they're a registered voter, you would go, if you're a college student, you would go to your local poll that's nearby. Do I have that right?
Right. So, for instance, I'll use my daughter again. The K-State student, the census would count her at K-State, but she could still vote in Johnson County. The residence is, the definition's a little different for census versus voting.
Right. So really, really no big impact on where you vote or when you complete your census form. There's really no fallout there whatsoever then.
No.
Yeah. You know, some state house observers say this is, you know, they do say it's one more example of political power trickling away from rural counties. Is there anything to that?
I don't believe so because, although, again, the theory was to help the rural counties, the way it's played out over the last three censuses, the rural counties didn't lose or gain from this adjustment. So why do it if it really has no change?
Yeah, yeah. Okay. So really no impact there whatsoever. Now, the Secretary of State's office has taken a little flack for posting a statement on its website from Secretary Schwab in favor of this change. Did he cross a line there, Clay? Because some Democrats are saying he might have.
I don't believe so. I can understand the Democrats' point. It took me a while to actually find this on our own website. It's a few levels in, but there's a copy of the amendment itself, which would be on the ballot, and there's a second document that's a little flyer that it tries to explain why this was approved by the legislature. Mm-hmm. It just essentially says what I've said today, saves money, saves time, replaces an antiquated system.
So from your standpoint, it's kind of a neutral set of observations then.
Yes. Now, granted, it supports it. I can understand where the Democrats are saying we need to be careful with this because next year there may be a much more controversial amendment. We don't want the Secretary of State taking sides on that. I think here it was just an attempt to give a little more background on why there was an overwhelming support for this.
I'm just wondering, Clay, how are voters going to figure this one out? Because there's been so little press on this, and it hasn't gotten very much attention except on good old public radio talk shows, you know, like this one. So how are voters going to navigate this thing?
There's going to be
a lot of confusion out there.
The staff have been going around the state talking to groups. Both political parties said they would put it out through their organizations. Legislators said they would urge their supporters. In Johnson County, for instance, the ballot will be the usual, the city, school board, water board, community college. And the last thing is this long, dense series of prose, which is the actual amendment with the language lined out, one word added in. We know there's a tendency of voters when they see something like this, they'll tend to vote yes, assuming it's got to be there for a reason.
Mm-hmm.
If they want to find out more, they can ask the Secretary of State or a legislator to explain it.
Okay, so again, the general rule of thumb here, little opposition to this idea. Your office is all for it, just so you would have them vote yes on this ballot initiative, constitutional amendment.
Urging everyone to vote yes. And I think the type of voter that comes out in these off-year municipal elections tends to be more involved with their communities and knowledge, and they'll be a little more informed of this. They won't walk in blind and just see language.
We have a tweet here from Sandy who's saying, you're assuming the state is efficient enough to make these phone calls. What student answers a phone call from the state? P.S. My son never received such a call while he was in college.
Exactly. Excellent point. We've done some preparation in case we have to do the adjustment. We're hoping this gets through. Yes, people don't answer phones as much as they did 10 years ago. We would have had alternative sources of emailing. Colleges asking students to just get online and fill this out. The military's a little easier because they can tell their soldiers to do it.
Right, right. What else is the Secretary of State's office working on these days, Clay Barker? Is there anything else that interesting initiatives you'd want to talk about here?
The office has essentially four divisions. The business services, which no one really hears about, is annual reports and notaries and uniform commercial code filings. The second is publications, statute books, session laws, journals, and then elections is the smallest group that gets the most attention. Improving voter security, the new post-election audits, training for all the different counties. And then there's a The fourth is kind of the headquarters. It does a lot of odds and ends stuff you never realize any part of government does.
Yeah. Let's go to some phone calls here. Nathan from, I'm not sure where Nathan's from. You're on Up to Date, Nathan. Good morning.
Yeah, I'm in Wyandotte County. Is it at all common for an amendment like this to end up on the ballot? Is that the only way these changes are made?
Yeah, why is it on the ballot, Clay?
All right, anytime the Constitution is amended, first, both houses of the legislature have to vote for it by a two-thirds majority. Governor doesn't sign this. It's not a bill. And then it has to go on the ballot. It could be at a primary election, but it's better to put it in a general when there's more turnout.
Yeah. Well, how much focus are you guys giving to election security as we head into the 2020 election, and what's been the latest on that front?
It's sort of two phases. We've been meeting with the Department of Homeland Security, the FBI. Now that elections are considered critical infrastructure, there's a lot of emphasis on it. Part of it is just to try to reduce misinformation that voters can get, where the fake Facebook posts or tweets that confuse people. I believe our system is very secure, that it can't be hacked getting into the vote itself.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes a county website might get defaced for a while. I mean, that's
people wonder about that. So you think the websites themselves are pretty safe?
I believe that the data itself is safe. The voting machines themselves are not connected to anything. That's mm-hmm. why they have to have the little cards going in and out and
right.
physically transferred. And there's a lot of attention of modernizing the system. I see there's been a little news lately that eight counties still have the slightly older,
right.
older voting machines that don't leave a paper trail.
Right.
That's just one component to a better system, but those counties will be replacing it soon.
Before the election.
Counties have to pay for it, so it becomes more of a matter of money sometimes.
Okay, that's Clay Barker. He's Deputy General Counsel in the Secretary of State's office talking about this proposed constitutional amendment that Kansans will be passing judgment on next month. Clay, thanks so much for your time. I sure appreciate it.
Thank you, Steve. Pleasure to be here.
You bet. Time for a break. When we come back, we'll be visiting with Alexi Pappas, who does a whole lot more than run in the Olympics. She's also now a budding movie actress. We'll also talk about Patrick Mahomes and his injury and what all this means for the Chiefs kingdom going forward. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And welcome back. I'm Steve Kraske. If you haven't heard, I have a newsletter called Kraske Off Mic. Subscribe at kcur.org/Kraske and get musings from me in your inbox each Monday afternoon. It only takes a few seconds to sign up at kcur.org/Kraske. Next week will be a good one. We'll talk gun violence and legislation with Republican lawmakers in Missouri, learn about online extremism and something else called techno-utopians. That's next week on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, there's a lot going on in the Kansas City sporting world right now that only begins with last night's Chiefs game. Also on tap this weekend, NASCAR at the Kansas Speedway. One event not getting as much attention is the Kansas City Marathon that kicks off at 7 o'clock tomorrow morning at Union Station. One of the participants is someone worth getting to know. Alexi Pappas is more than just another Olympian. Yes, she holds the Greek national record in the 10,000 meters with a personal best of 31:36 set at the Rio Olympics, but she's also an actress and author with two movies now under her belt. She's getting a reputation as, something of a cult figure, with the LA Times concluding that while so many of us sit on our couches, Pappas is an Olympian, director, screenwriter, and actress before the age of 30. We'll get to the Chiefs and NASCAR in just a few minutes, but first, let's say hello to Alexi Pappas, and welcome to Kansas City. So good to have you here.
Thank you for having me. I'm so happy to be back.
Also with us is Greg Elklin, who covers sports for KCUR. Greg, good morning to you.
Good morning, Steve.
My sense, Alexi, is that the films you've done, Olympic Dreams coming out next year and Trackdown from 2016, are meant to be entertaining, but also to provide some insights, I guess, into what it's like to be a world-class athlete. One thing you focus on is what happens after so many years of training and sacrifice if you don't win. What happens?
I think that for everybody, regardless of whether you're chasing an Olympic dream or some other dream, there's some level of hope or expectation or imagining what it might be like when you get there and
right.
what it really looks like.
Right.
And I think, you know, for some, it can exceed your expectations. For some, it can fall short. And we do look at in our films or in my films what it looks like the moment after you're done and how does that feel? Because most Olympians, I think every Olympian doesn't prepare for the moment after, because if you prepare for that moment, you might not get to the Olympics itself.
What is that moment like, the moment after? What was it like for you?
You know, for every athlete that I know, including myself, it was a tremendously unexpected, honestly, like a bit of a dip, because you have had this goal that you've been aiming for maybe your entire life.
Absolutely.
And regardless of how it goes, because I ran out of my mind. Like, I ran the best I'd ever run. I've never felt like that in a race. I have friends, a friend won the gold medal and similarly felt this sense of a dip afterwards that I think we're very unprepared for because
right.
so few people talk about it.
When you say dip, Alexa, are you talking about just outright depression? Is it like, what's the point of my life now?
Yeah,
is it that dramatic?
I think it's called a post-Olympic depression, and I do think that it's not an unhealthy thing. I think it's actually a very, in retrospect, makes perfect sense. I think what's hard about it is when you don't expect it, and that's with anything. When you're in the middle of a race, you can expect a hill that you know is going to be there, but if something happens during a race that you don't expect, it's often harder than the hurdles that you do.
Mm-hmm.
And so I actually think it's more that there's not so much of a dialogue that that's possible, and maybe some athletes have mentors that prepare them, but for those who don't, it's more that you're surprised because you don't expect it.
Yeah.
That's more challenging, I think, than the feeling itself, because the feeling fades. You figure out, you move on, you get the next goal, or you set a new goal, or you simply give yourself time to reinflate. Like, I often think about a marshmallow that kind of gets all squished up and then can kind of, it can come back to its shape. And so
right.
it's not a bad thing. It means you've put a lot into something.
You know, you said that you ran out of your mind at the Olympics when you set a personal best. Did you know it at the time? Did you feel like you were coming out of your skin a little bit, or what was that like?
I did.
I mean, you're at the Olympics, right? I mean,
yeah.
you would think that every athlete would be reaching personal best, but I know that's not the case.
You know, I was so like grateful to have a coach that prepared me physically so that my body could do exactly what my mind told it to do.
No kidding.
And I've never felt so much so that my body and my mind were on the same page. And when you feel that way, you begin to kind of hover above yourself while it's happening. And you can actually almost watch yourself performing while you're performing, and it is a really, really remarkable feeling that you can't have every race because it's such a, you know, coming together of, you know, stars and training and magic, but I had it on the right day, and it was a joy.
Did you know as you began the race, did you have a sense that this was going to go well? Were you feeling something special that day?
Yeah, I felt that I was fully prepared, and maybe that was trusting the coach and trusting the program, and he was an Olympian himself who did not peak in the same way at his own Olympics, and so I think he was really thoughtful about it. But you do have that feeling, I think, when you get off the start line, at least in a track race. Now, for the marathon, I'm still new-ish to that sport, and as I understand it, it can actually be quite different in the marathon, where you might feel a certain way at the beginning, and that can ebb and flow. And so I think a marathon, we shouldn't feel so much like we know the outcome at the beginning, because as I understand it, it can be a little more mysterious.
Mm-hmm. Well, you ran 10,000 meters. That's the race we're talking about here, where you experienced your personal best. I did a little math, and you already know this, but this is 6.2 miles, in case people trying to wrap their arms around it. Why did you pick that race? Because that sounds, for someone like myself who's always struggled to run distance, that's never been my thing. I'm more of a sprinter type. Why did you pick that distance? Because it strikes me as so hard.
It was interesting to me because I knew, you know, I've always thrived on other people believing in me. Like, I've thrived on finding coaches that help give me permission to believe in myself. And I think mentorship is so important in that we can never outgrow having mentors, no matter how old we are. And I had a mentor, a coach, who expressed that I would be a great distance runner. And I was a bit of a late bloomer in the sport. I played other sports growing up. I did theater. And so I hadn't tried the 10,000 until after college, which is a little bit late for an athlete. And so I wasn't yet ready to be the full-on distance runner that a marathoner might be. But the 10,000 really represented the longest distance I could run within reason. And so I guess I chose it because other people believed in me and it felt like an event where I could push myself as much mentally as physically.
I was going to say, it just means you're having to push yourself for 6.2 miles. That's such a long time to be pushing yourself. I mean, a mile race is one thing. 6 miles, you know, I just wonder about the mental challenge of taking on a race like that.
Yeah, and particularly on the track because it's very repetitive. So you're running 25 laps on a track.
Yeah.
And I think that's the other thing that's exciting about this race here is that there's the benefit.
You're on the streets of the marathon. Yeah.
Yeah, you have endless eye candy, endless entertainment of being maybe in a new city or maybe you're seeing a different view of the city you've grown up in. And so I think there's something special about road races where in a track race, it is a little bit more of a mind game of, you know, in Rio in particular, the stadium was very symmetrical around. And so it was actually very hard to even tell what moment in a lap that you were on.
How would you know? Did you ever lose track?
I did lose track. I thought that I was on my last lap and I had one additional lap to run. And it was fine, but I just began my finishing kick, my sprint that you would have loved too soon. And then I was like, you know what? I did this to myself. I'm just going to hold it. And so maybe I ran a few seconds faster because I, you know, made that mistake.
You know, I just wondering a couple things about an Olympic race. I mean, stepping to the starting line at the Olympics has got to be a moment. What was that like?
It's a moment, and it was unexpectedly intimate among the competitors because you spend a lot of time with them beforehand. They check you in 2 hours before the race, which is really a long time for a runner to be held in a pin. And when you step out, there's that sense of togetherness with all of your competitors, and it's almost like us against this whole situation because it is so overwhelming when you step out and there's this sense of respect among the athletes that you all just want to go out there and have integrity with the race and all run out of your minds. And actually this race, the world record was broken in the 10,000. And I think, you know, an unusually high number of athletes ran personal bests and national records, including myself. And I think that was no doubt thanks to that sense of camaraderie and respect that we all had, where it was like, look, let's get it going, let's all do this, and it became more.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
What place did you finish?
I think I was like 17th, but most years I think the time would have been 8th, which isn't something that I say very often, but it was just to say that everybody ran so well.
Yeah. Olympian Alexi Pappas is my guest. She's joined by Greg Eklund with KCUR Sports. Greg, I'm coming to you. I know I'm so absorbed in my conversation Alexi here. You also read about the start of these races, Alexi. A lot of jostling around, a lot of aggressiveness early on as runners establish position. Does it get tough?
Yes.
A lot of banging around?
Track is definitely a contact sport in many
ways. People don't think of it that way.
They don't. And again, I think you know, circling back to our earlier conversation about expectation and surprise, I fell down in a European championship about a month before my Olympic race, and it was my first international competition, and I learned that international competitions can be very aggressive, and I fell and my leg was bleeding and I finished the race covered in blood. But what it really gave me was the vocabulary to understand that you can fall down, so that when the Olympics came, I had in my mind that it was possible to get tripped, and rather than get surprised when it did happen, I was determined that if somebody, you know, falls in front of me or steps in a weird way, I am not falling down. And in Rio, there was a moment when there was a tumble, and I had to just like plow through this girl where a month earlier I might have fallen with her out of surprise, if that makes sense.
But you didn't fall, but you just had to work around the woman who fell.
I had to step on somebody, basically, which is what you have to do sometimes. But if you don't have that muscle, I don't know, that acceptance that like you might have to do what it takes to not fall down, then you might fall down as well.
What's the jostling over? Just for position in the race, or what's happening there?
It's, you want to be as close to the rail, the inside of the lane, as you can, so you don't have to run farther than your 10K.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think basically the 10K is a race of attrition. So it's more about who can maintain, and rather than these like heroic sprints that other events might present. And so if somebody is starting to fall off, maybe they don't want to give way to somebody who can still maintain the pace. And so you have to assert yourself. And it's almost like breaking up with someone. Like if you realize the girl in front of you is starting to fall off pace, so that you have to move on and go around them so that you continue to have integrity with your pace.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes that can be aggressive because somebody doesn't want to accept that new positioning, if that makes sense.
There were 37 runners in your race. That's a lot of runners. That's a big pack of people.
It's a big pack, and I actually started out in almost last because my coach gave me these guidelines of like, I don't think it's smart to go out faster than X pace. For me, it was like 5 minute mile pace. And what ended up happening is that I went out in the pace that my coach and I had planned. Mm-hmm. I went out with our race plan, and everybody else went out with the girl that would eventually lap everyone and broke the world record.
Oh, wow.
And slowly, 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 I just like caught girl after girl after girl. I never got passed in the race. Mm-hmm. I only passed people, which was a nice feeling. And it was also smart. But in reality,
gives you confidence as the race is going along.
Yeah. But in reality, I didn't really change pace that much. It just, it might have appeared so, but actually it was just girls were falling off slowly over time.
Greg Eklund, let's talk about this Kansas City Marathon coming up tomorrow morning in town, because it's going to change traffic patterns in Kansas City, as it always does.
Yep.
Our listeners should be forewarned. There'll be street closings and the like. How many people we got? How's this thing going to roll out?
Well, there are going to be about 10,000 runners
10,
on the streets. 10,000.
Alexi Pappas is one of 10,000.
Yes.
Instead of one of 37. Yeah.
A world-class athlete among them, like Alexi.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to be marathoners.
No pressure there, Alexi. Yeah.
And to clarify, I'm running the 5K tomorrow.
Oh, you're running
You run the 5K?
Yeah. So I'm going to help. I'm going to start, help
can
start
you get,
the
can
race.
Can you get through a 5K? Okay, Alexi,
I hope
need
some
so. Help.
Yeah, I hope so. I'm going to help start the marathon. I'm going to do everything I can to help those athletes out. And then I'm going to sprint my little race and then make sure I'm there at the finish to greet all those marathoners.
How long will it take you to do a 5K? Like 24 seconds, or is it more than that?
You know what? Let's not put a time on it. Let's just see, right?
Let's see what happens.
And that's actually going to be one of four categories. It'll be 5Ks, 10Ks, half marathoners, and the marathoners.
Yeah. And which one are you doing, Greg?
Neither. None of the above.
None of the above. Yeah. Okay. No. And lots of streets being closed here, right?
Lots of streets. Starts out around the Union Station area, goes north to downtown, and then eventually works its way through the 18th and Vine District, and then a little bit further west, and then south, like toward the Waldo area, through the plaza. So There are going to be some streets closures, I would say, on the western end. You know, if you want to take a north-south route on the western end of the course, State Line Road, you could go north and south without any obstacles. And on the east end of the course, so you could probably go up and down Troost without any obstacles.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
If you're traveling, because most of the closures will be taking place between 7 in the morning, and most of the streets will probably be reopened at around 1 in the afternoon.
I got you. You know, Lexi, I'm just, again, struck by your films, Olympic Dreams and Track Town, Olympic Dreams coming out next year, that you're really trying to show people aspects of that world that maybe they're not aware of. Things like what? Even like the eating, the nutrition, the loneliness. Yeah.
All of those things. I think there are plenty of sports films or content out there where you see athletes on the playing field. That's most of sports, you know, coverage. That's most of what we see on NBC in the Olympics.
Mm-hmm.
And what we are doing is just peeling the curtain back a little bit and showing a side of the sport that is represents, you know, the in-between competitions, mm-hmm. all those quieter moments, or just the moments where you see that these athletes are growing up, coming of age, just like anybody, whether they're an Olympian or not. It's just they're in this highly intense and specific and extreme environment where, you know, your emotions are also at an extreme.
Yeah. I was struck that this film that you have coming out, Olympic Dreams, you guys got permission to become the first scripted film approved by the Olympic Committee to actually be shot during the Olympics. How tough was it to get that kind of permission?
You know, the president of the Olympics, Thomas Bach, is such a supporter. He's really, really forward thinking in terms of trying to bring back the arts into the Olympic spirit, which it's always historically been a huge value to them. And he saw Track Town, my previous film, on an airplane and really liked, you know, what we had done with that movie, and invited us to make this film project. And then we grew it into the feature that it was organically with the Olympics. I think they didn't necessarily, they weren't like, go shoot a feature film, but we're like, well, if we capture enough content, can we do this thing? And they were very supportive. And I was also really respectful of the athletes, mm-hmm. knowing when to approach an athlete and when to leave them alone, because they're about to compete. And so I think there's a thoughtfulness to it, for sure.
You know, I was struck that both of your films deal with this idea that there's this life, you know, beyond running, romance, whatever. To what extent did that reflect your own desires to sort of move your life away from competition at some point?
You know, for me, I've always wanted to experience the highest level of the worlds I'm in, whether it's running, you know, and being around the greatest minds and bodies and running and absorbing what I can from that, or creative. And now I do have these, you know, stronger and stronger curiosities and also more and more permission to pursue the arts.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm taking those opportunities. I'm writing a book with Random House right now, which will come out next year.
It's called Bravery, right? And it's a set of essays, I believe.
It's a memoir and essays called Bravey. And Bravey.
Okay.
Which is a made up word. So I don't blame you for.
Yeah.
Yeah. And yes, I would say that I think athletes have a challenging decision to make of when do you move on, and how do you create an environment where you don't become bitter to your sport, because your sport has given you so much. And I think what I want to do is just keep pausing at thoughtful intervals and evaluating what am I doing and why am I doing it. I think mm-hmm. that's the biggest thing for anyone chasing a goal, is to be in it when you're in the goal and not question the goal. And then pick intervals of time where you reevaluate, what is the goal? Why am I doing this? What do I want next? And that check-in could be with yourself or with your coach or with your husband or, you know. And so I'm definitely very thoughtful and having those check-ins with myself regularly, or and not too regularly.
Well, that's Alexi Pappas, who will be competing in the 5K tomorrow. She's taking a day off, I guess, from the rest of training. Alexi, it's so great to have you here. Thanks for taking some time with us, okay?
Thank you for having me. It is a city that I've long loved, and I feel so welcomed here. So thank you.
Well, Greg, let's just visit for a few minutes about stuff going on, other things happening in our community when it comes to sports. There's a big event at the Speedway this weekend. Is Alexi Pappas going to drive a car out there, or what do we know about that?
I don't think I'll see her climbing in a vehicle with four wheels and going around 180 miles an hour on the Trioval at Kansas Speedway this weekend. But full weekend out there, racing tonight and tomorrow, all leading into the Hollywood Casino 400 on Sunday. And what is significant about the NASCAR race this Sunday at Kansas Speedway is the fact that it's part of the playoffs. So there are drivers who are vying to advance in the NASCAR playoffs, among them Clint Bowyer from Emporia, but there is going to be a cut of drivers who do not advance in the playoffs, and Bowyer is one of those drivers who's on the cusp of not making it to the next stage of the playoffs.
Okay, the T-Bones have new ownership, Greg. That's a story just breaking today, I believe.
It just broke. The Commission of the Unified Government of Wyandotte County in Kansas City, Kansas, voted last night for the transfer of ownership from the Ellert family to a new company called Max Fun Entertainment. So the final approval will come from the American Association, but things are looking up for the Kansas City T-Bones.
Okay.
And I should say that there'll be a story posted on KCUR.org on that in depth.
And just finally, the latest news we have this hour when it comes to Patrick Mahomes is what? How long is he going to be out?
A developing story, but Ian Rappaport, who reports for the NFL Network, says at least 3 weeks because of a dislocated right knee.
Mm-hmm. How was the defense last night?
Well, the defense was outstanding last night and carried the Chiefs under the circumstances in which they played without Patrick Mahomes, Matt Moore being the backup quarterback, but the defense was the standout body last night.
And that's the first time this season we've seen the defense stand out in any way, shape, or form, right?
No doubt about it.
Tell us about Matt Moore, because a year ago, he wasn't even playing football, I don't believe.
He was a teacher and a coach in Florida. He was out of football for a full season, pretty much recovering from being a battered quarterback from his days with the Miami Dolphins.
The word battered underlined, he got beat up pretty good in
those
days, it
sounds
like.
He got beat up pretty good because of ineffective offensive lines protecting him down there.
Okay, that's Greg Eklund, who covers sports for KCUR News. Greg, thanks so much.
You're welcome. I appreciate it.
Well, from what we understand, another World Series is set to start next week. However, fans of the Kansas City Royals are looking ahead a little farther than that. Commentator Victor Wishna elaborates in this October edition of A Fan's Notes.
Oh, somewhere in this favored land, the playoffs are still going on. But for baseball fans in Kansas City, the calendar has already turned to that mythical time of the year when anything is possible. Not the postseason, not the preseason, the off-season. Sometimes the fortunes of an entire franchise can turn on a single moment. Salvador Perez's crazy wild-card winning line drive comes to mind. But really, change, like most things in baseball, happens a bit more gradually, through some crafty drafting, patient prospect development, and every once in a while, a bold move from the front office. This Royals offseason is already shaping up to be one of the more transformative in recent memory. A new owner, a new manager, and, well, the same old GM who has been known to take a chance or two. Even before new ownership takes over, the Royals have some money to play with. They could add $40 or $50 million to next year's payroll and still be well short of recent peak spending. Sure, the prudent thing is not to waste that cash while continuing to rebuild. But that was also the smart move heading into 2013, when, instead, general manager Dayton Moore traded top prospects for ace James Shields and another pitcher named Wade Davis. That didn't seem like it was going to work out until, well, it totally worked out. If you insist on measuring success by wins and losses, the 2019 Royals were, not good. But they improved dramatically in the second half of the season, and the roster now boasts the league's hottest hitter and biggest slugger. Whit Merrifield led the American League in hits for the second year in a row, and Jorge Soler is the first actual home run king in Royals history. Others emerged. Hunter Dozier came on late to become a real threat at the plate. And before being sidelined by injury, shortstop Adalberto Mondesi razzled enough dazzle to justify his early hype, and now just needs to get healthy. Oh, and speaking of healthy, Salvador Perez, wildcard hero, World Series MVP, is back. With so many pieces in place, maybe an added kick in free agency could start to tip the scales. Perhaps a couple of veteran inning eaters of the type that shored up the rotation in 2015. Maybe a reliable veteran first baseman. And hey, after the best season of his career, Mike Moustakas will be back on the market, and probably at a good value. No, I haven't heard any rumors of a Moose sighting, but I am trying to start one. Of course, it will all rise on a new foundation. This season saw a final toast to Ned Yost, and perhaps a fond, very fond, farewell to Alex Gordon. Perhaps even Kauffman Stadium's days are numbered, as the change in owners has revived the chatter about a new downtown ballpark. So that's something to look forward to in, say, the year 2032. After back-to-back 100-loss seasons, there's nowhere to go but up, right? While those World Series runs were nice, we're Royals fans. We know slumps can be measured in decades. The outlook isn't yet brilliant, but it will be interesting to see what comes next. Change doesn't happen overnight. And with opening day just 5 months away, there's no time to lose. That's the way
baseball goes. Victor Wishna is an editor, writer, and sports fan. He lives in Leawood. Yesterday on the program, actors Michael Learned and actor Charlie Robinson talked of the love they portray in The Last Romance. Hear them and other conversations online at kcur.org/uptodate. You can find and follow us on Twitter. We're at kcuruptodate. You can follow me at Steve Kraske, and don't forget to like KCUR on Facebook. Monday on the show, all things health insurance. The smart money experts are back to share critical factors in making your choice of health coverage. Join us. Our theme music is composed by the great Bobby Watson. We had help this week from Linda Scher, Paul Nakatura, Maria Carter, Sam Zeff, Brian Ellison, Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Elizabeth Ruiz, and Jamie Hobbs. Have a great weekend, all. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date. That's the way baseball goes. Now let's play ball.